Right, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you very much for coming this afternoon. My name, if you've not met me before, is Elizabeth Berridge, Baroness Berridge, and I'm the co-chair of the All-Party Group on Freedom of Religion or Belief. And Catherine Fain, our operations director, is here, and Gurinda Yarns is at the back there. So if you want, if members want to find out any more information about what the All-Party Group does, please ask them afterwards. Forgive me that my voice isn't very strong at the moment. I've got a bit of the winter lurgy. But it's a real privilege to have. Canon Thompson came with the recommendation of Alistair Burt, who I think you met during his time as a Foreign Office Minister for the Middle East and North Africa. We, of course, do a lot about the areas of the world where there is religious persecution, and so I'd come across Gerard Russell's excellent book, who will also be speaking to us, called Heirs to Forgotten Kingdoms, which is about the people groups across the Middle East, and I think probably knew about the Yazidis before any of us had heard of them through the coverage in the press. And also Andrew Thompson very kindly sent me his book, Christianity in the United Arab Emirates. And it seems from my cursory look at the book, I haven't read it, I'm afraid, yet from cover to cover, this is a more positive story than what we're all currently hearing about the plight of religious minorities, particularly Christians in the region. We have until 6:30, but I'm aware that for many members, an hour is usually the maximum period of time they can spare. So what we'll do, Gerard has a wider context to this issue. Just to say, though, to members, if you're not already a member of the All-Party Parliamentary Group, please let us know. You then receive a twice-weekly email monitoring about the media and the events that are happening in Parliament, and also questions and debates to get involved with, and our staff are there to help you and resource you if you want to contribute to any of those. So Gerald will give us about 5 or so minutes to give us the background to the region and to what's going on. And then Canon Thompson will speak for about 15 or so minutes, and then you'll have a time for question and answer. Just to let you know that the microphones are not for amplification, not on either, so if we can all speak up. So thank you very much for coming, and over to Gerard.
Well, thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. I am a Christian, and I was an Arabist in the Foreign Office for 14 years and served in Cairo and Jerusalem and Baghdad and Jeddah and Kabul. So all sorts of experiences of Christian worship, from a secret location with a priest whose real name was unknown in one case to, makeshift chapels in army barracks, and of course the sort of immense antiquity of Eastern Christianity. And I did not know anything really about the Gulf, the Arab Gulf, until I became an advisor to the UAE government in 2011, which I still do. And that's how I met Andy, and also sort of began to really understand a bit more about a part of the world that I hadn't really known before. And I should say a thanks to the UAE Embassy, which very kindly has helped Andy to come here today and to have the airfare and hotel bills, and has also not at all told him what to say. And I think if we're right, we're here under sort of Chatham House rules anyway. Andy can... I'm happy to be on the record myself. But what I wanted to sort of do was really look at that part of the world that I know best, and in particular this map, which I think is really intriguing when you know what it is. It's a set of places from Damascus in the west into Mosul, Hamadan, down to Socotra, across to Tibet, across to places in China near to Beijing. And that is the locations, some of the locations of Christian bishoprics in the year 800 AD. In other words, not only are we talking about an era in time, 1,200 years ago, and yet those places we think of as being so distant were then centres of Christian life, but also we're talking about 150 years after the Christian church which ruled those bishoprics had come under the rule of Islam, because the bishop or the patriarch of the Church of the East lived for the most part in Seleucia Ctesiphon, which is really within modern Baghdad. And so it's a reminder that even in those early eras, I wouldn't say that there was, you know, equality or tolerance, because these words are overused. You know, it wasn't a very good thing to be someone who wasn't part of the state religion, but there was the capacity for acceptance of the other. By the way, this church, you know, which today is tiny, today the Church of the East is almost extinct, but it then comprised about 20% of the entire Christian population of the world. And it was from Iraq or Iran that Christianity first reached China in the about 630 AD in the shape of a man called Alopen, probably an Aramaic speaker. And by the way, this Mosul in 2005 for the Iraqi elections was a place where you could still see Aramaic Syriac signs used for the local Christians. So it's very important, I think, alongside all the terrible news that we have and some of the terrible news that I'm about to say, just to remember that it hasn't always been this way, it doesn't have to be this way, and there's nothing intrinsic about Islam or Christianity that means that there always has to be tension and warfare between them. For example, in the 1860s, you had the ruler of Egypt, the Khedive Ismail, saying to his ministers, when one of them criticized another of the officials for being a Christian, he said, "We're all Egyptians alike." And that is, you know, at a time before, really, in Europe, I think there would have been the same spirit of equality and acceptance for Jews, for example. Now, even as recently as 1987, you had 1.4 million Christians in Iraq. We know that from the census. It was quite a good census taken in 1987. And the population as a whole was just over 16 million. In other words, 10% of Iraq was then Christian. Today, when I was in Erbil a year ago, Bishop Bashar Warda, who is the Chaldean Archbishop of Erbil, he reckoned probably 400,000 Christians remained, I would guess now. It's fewer, perhaps 300,000. In other words, about 1%, because the population of Iraq now is around 33 million. And you have in Egypt, this is a small village near Minya. And a reminder again, in this small village here, these priests live alongside and a majority Muslim population. In their village, the mayor is a Christian by long tradition. It isn't necessarily the case that there is tension, but there is, frankly, according to the priests, a younger generation that they see as changing the customs of those who came before, as having a different attitude inculcated in them very often at school. Since the 1970s, they believe, and it's a common thing to hear in Egypt, that the growth of Islamism in the state system filtered down into the education system to the point where the schools encourage people to some extent to see Christians as being less Egyptian, less patriotic, if you like, than Muslims. And those political differences have, of course, been exacerbated by the turbulence of Egypt in recent years. I suppose the most clear example I had was really in Iraq. You know, if you talk to people who were in Iraq, Christians, for example, in Baghdad, it wasn't the case necessarily that they felt a great hatred from their neighbours. In fact, they often said to me that they felt, you know, they got on very well with their Muslim neighbours, but that you had gangs entering at night, you had occasional families that appeared to be spying on them. Kidnap was very common, kidnap for money, kidnap for political reasons. And over time, if you are from a, you know, if you feel vulnerable, and very often what they would say is that they felt unwanted in their own country, they would move to Kurdistan, where there are other problems. You'll have to learn Kurdish if you've always been brought up as an Arab. If you regard yourself as an Iraqi Arab, for all that you're a Christian, and you have to move to Kurdistan, it is effectively, it feels to them like a foreign country. And there has been straightforward persecution. And going to, I was in August last year in Erbil, as I say, and talking to those who had been driven out of Mosul, very often they said, you know, they would say things like, "We never thought it would happen. Nothing like it has ever happened before." Which is not quite true. Things like it had happened before, but not for a very long time, not for two generations. And so, that, you know, at the same time, you see the real feeling of the majority of Iraqis, which was not that they wished to engage in persecution of the other, but also their powerlessness, in effect, in the face of those small and very determined groups that were prepared to use violence and were prepared to drive others out. And this is a very, it's sad to say, it's a widening trend. I mean, Aid to the Church in Need reports that more Christians are targeted by religious persecution than any other religious group, and a large part of that is in the Middle East. So it's very important to realise the scale of the problem, but also to sort of carefully identify its causes, because I think there is a sort of defeatism that creeps in, a defeatism that I think is born of a sort of unwillingness to look deeply at the causes. Perhaps some people may think that it's inevitable that Islam and Christianity will have this clash. I don't think so at all myself. I think there was enormous progress in the Arab world in the 20th century, which has really gone backwards in the last 40 years. I don't think the reasons for that are simple at all. I think there are many reasons for it, which include new technology, include globalization, include conflict and instability, include, you know, the West's own choices, because in the 70s we preferred Islamism as an alternative to communism, and indeed to nationalism. So I'm not saying, I wanted to sort of give you, in a sense, that what I hope was a sort of nuanced portrait, perhaps some of the bad news. I don't know whether Andy is going to give good news, but I thought it was useful just to set a context in which, of course, the UAE, the Arab Gulf, is really a small part by population of the Arab world. Iraq is far larger, Egypt larger still, Pakistan, of course, larger by far. And yet, some of the trends, some of the way that people think, some of the developments in human relations can be studied, I think, in any of these places, and we can learn wider lessons. I believe book launches are forbidden here, so I haven't said anything about, Baroness Berridge very kindly mentioned my book, but it really talks not only about the Christians, not only about that wonderful Church of the East, and the ability one has, by the way, to hear Aramaic, if not in Iraq so much, but at least in Detroit in the United States, where so many Iraqis have gone to live, but also about the other religions of the Middle East, because traditionally it was a very, very rich tapestry indeed, and there is a great deal to learn from that about the history of humanity, about the history of our ability to live alongside each other, and occasionally not.
Thank you very much, Gerard, and thank you for your encouraging news of your view that there's nothing intrinsic, that this isn't something that we have to accept, that the world's two greatest faiths would come into conflict like this. I now pass over to Canon Thompson, and forgive the lemsip, I forgot to just do introductions before we started. Canon Thompson has lived in the Middle East and the Gulf for much of his life, and comes from St Andrew's Church in Abu Dhabi since June 2010. And he's the longest serving, I don't want to make this sound like a prison sentence, the longest serving Anglican clergyman in the Gulf, and has previously lived in Bahrain and Kuwait, and has been awarded in 2011 an MBE for his work in interfaith relations. So over to you.
Thank you. I'm going to get down. Thank you, Rick. It's a privilege to be here. Most people, when they meet me for the first time, spend a lot of time wondering why I speak the way I do. So some people think it's because I have a speech impediment caused by a cleft palate. No, I don't have a cleft palate. Some people think it's because I come from Birmingham. No, it's got nothing to do with me coming from Birmingham. It's because I was born profoundly deaf. And so I grew up, and as a consequence, I have a speech impediment, which affects the way I talk today. All of that is by way of saying, if at the end, when you start asking me questions, and you ask me a question and I don't respond, it could mean one of two things. One is, I simply didn't hear you, and if I have a blank look in my face, you probably need to repeat it, and I will ask you to repeat it. Or two, it means, I think that's a really difficult question, I don't know the answer to that, therefore I'm going to ignore you. You have to decide which. But what I want to talk to you about today is Christianity in the UAE, an alternative narrative. United Arab Emirates is a relatively new country, and that's something which is really important to remember. This year, they celebrate their 44th anniversary as a country. I am older than the United Arab Emirates, and without sounding too cheeky, I think most of you in this room are older than the United Arab Emirates. In one generation, they have accomplished amazing things. They've gone from a subsistence tribal economy through to being an incredibly sophisticated capitalist kind of city mode. And all of it was led by a man with no education, a child of a desert, well and truly. He doesn't know the day he was born. There was no birth record around when he was born. Sheikh Zayed bin Sultan Al Nahyan, who is widely regarded as the father of the nation. And I dedicate my presentation to him today. Most people, when they hear I'm a pastor in the Middle East, they say something along the lines of, ooh, that's really dangerous, you're part of a persecuted church. And that's the kind of uniform they would expect me to wear. United Arab Emirates, although it is authentically Islamic, has a good news and a very alternative story in the way they allow religious freedom for the Christian community in particular, so much so that they encourage me to write books for the public realm. And by public, I really do mean public. These are two books which were endorsed by members of the ruling family of Abu Dhabi and which are sold in the public bookshops of their shopping malls in Dubai and Abu Dhabi and Bahrain, at the airport. And so in this Muslim country, you can buy a book on Jesus of Arabia, you can buy a book talking about the Christians who live in the United Arab Emirates. No other Gulf country allows that. I just want to show you a video now. Unfortunately, the sound system is coming out of the laptop, but they are subtitled on the screen. This introduces you to the church that I actually work in Abu Dhabi, just to give you some background and context. We have all these groups meeting back to back in 10 halls in our campus. This is just one day in one building in our compound. The clock at the top shows approximately about 3,000 Christians of different languages and traditions meeting throughout the day of Friday. Most of you wish you could hear sermons at this speed. Moving on. United Arab Emirates has a long history with Britain. Before it was called the United Arab Emirates, it was known as the Truce of States. And that was back in the 1820s, the British government established a relationship with the ruling tribes and agreed that they would protect their interests in return for them not attacking British trading interests, particularly with the Indian Empire at that time. And since then, members of the ruling family have sent their children and leading members of the tribe to places like Britain, where they go through boarding schools and go through the British university system. One of the sheikhs I'm very close to actually sang in the school choir in a British boarding school. He's been to church more times than I have. And there's this deep affection for Her Majesty, for the Church of England, which is really surprising when you're in a very Arab and Islamic environment. So when we look at the figures of the GCC, the Gulf Cooperative Council, which consists of Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Bahrain, Oman and Qatar, the United Arab Emirates really stands out when it comes to permission of Christian worship. At the most, Kuwait has six centres of worship, Saudi Arabia has no official places of worship. A United Arab Emirates, by contrast, in the neighbourhood, has over 40 centres of Christian worship. And by centres, I'm talking about places like St Andrew's, which host multiple congregations. Next door to St Andrew's Church, we have a Roman Catholic Church, which hosts 45,000 worshippers every single week. This is the biggest problem I have as a vicar of the United Arab Emirates is car parking control and crowd control. It's not your typical vicar's problem. And it's interesting too to see the development of the population in the United Arab Emirates of nearly 8 million people, nearly 10% of the population are Christian. And so they cater for that very large percentage. It's not always been good news. The British exercised quite stern diplomacy, particularly when we were dealing with the perceived pirates of the Pirate Coast, as it was also known in those days. And so they bombed Ras Al Khaimah, one of the Emirates, a memory which Emiratis still talk about. So it's quite astonishing in view of the difficulties they've had with Christians that they accommodate us. And one of the intriguing questions is to ask why. As Gerard touched on, there's a long history. The ancient church went east and St. Thomas planted churches across Iraq and travelled through southeastern Arabia on the way to India. And in that time, there was 400 to 500 years of a Christian presence, a Nestorian church known as the Church of the East, which had well-established monasteries and churches and places of worship in Southeast Arabia. We even think they had a seminary there. One of the great scholars of the Nestorian church was St. Isaac of Nineveh. He was born, we think, in Abu Dhabi, or what is now Abu Dhabi. So there was a well-established Christian presence there. Later in the 1900s, the American missionaries came, Richard Samuel Dwamer, who pioneered medical mission into Arabia, and they planted hospitals. This is Dr. Paul Harrison. This is in 1901 when he visited Sharjah, one of the Emirates, and treated the Sheikh of Sharjah at that time. Among that pioneering group of missionaries were women. This is the first lady doctor from the United States. And all of these missionaries did two things which endeared them to the local people. They learned Arabic, and they dressed as the locals dressed, by and large. And so they were accessible, they expressed their love for the people, and they did that in such a way to command the respect of the ruling family. This is Dr. Pat Kennedy, who came in the 1950s, and he became a personal friend of Sheikh Zayed, who invited him to build a hospital in the heartland of Al-Ain, where the tribes come from. Most of the ruling family today in the United Arab Emirates were born in this hospital. And today, when you go to Al-Ain, Oasis Hospital, there are Bible verses and Bibles in every single room, there by permission from the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Zayed al-Nahyan, in tribute, in effect, to the work of the early Christian missionary who came before oil, before air conditioning. And that's a big consideration taken. Air conditioning is a must. It's now calming, cooling down to about 45 degrees centigrade at the moment. So winter is on its way. Hooray. And then the Sheikh Zayed, in a tribute to the missionaries, and because of those missionaries, gave land to the church. This is the Archbishop of Jerusalem receiving land in Abu Dhabi, and that was back in 1968. Before then, the Anglicans were there, sent by British Petroleum to minister to the oil workers, and this is one of the early Anglican chaplains ministering to the oil workers on the island of Dar in the Arabian Gulf. And these are the very first churches that were built in the United Arab Emirates around the late 1960s. Today, the Christian population have exploded to include not just Anglicans, but Ethiopian Orthodox. They provide much of the domestic labourers for the Emiratis and expat force. We have the Egyptian Coptic Orthodox Church, and they're a very large community. This building can hold up to 2,000 worshippers. They actually get 7,000 worshippers come every Friday. This is the Greek Orthodox Church. There are so many of these people that have to literally stand outside the church in order to worship. We have the evangelical churches, we have the Pentecostal churches, and then, of course, the sheikhs regularly come in an expression of support for the church. A few years ago, a bomb went off in Egypt, and Al-Qaeda listed the church in Abu Dhabi as a target to blow up. And so what happened that Christmas, most of the ruling family went to church. In an expression of their support for the Christian community, and Al-Qaeda was going to get the message, you do not represent our Islam. As I mentioned, the Catholic Church is huge. Their outdoor masses in temperatures of up to 50 degrees centigrade really test your devotion and your commitment. This is myself taking Sheikh Nahyan to church, who is a member of a ruling family, during Remembrance Sunday, which of course is coming up next week. We've just celebrated the opening of our new facilities, and this is what it looks like today. Multiple halls and meeting rooms that hold up to 10,000 people, and the future looks like that's the British ambassador with our bishop, the Catholic bishop, and Sheikh Nahyan. So what value do we give to the United Arab Emirates? We have pioneered in the oil and gas industry. We built the first hospitals. We built the first schools. And in the future, we want to deepen our interfaith relationships. We want to contribute to the community care of the massive population that is increasingly moving over to Abu Dhabi in search of jobs and economic prosperity. We also want to be ambassador for the United Arab Emirates in the conviction that here is a model of an Islamic nation who've got it right when it comes to religious freedom and pluralism. The gift the UAE has given to us is it brought churches together. They've provided employment for literally thousands of people from all around the world. They've given us a safe and secure environment. We have religious freedom. It's a global community, very cosmopolitan. We see an Islam which does not persecute Christians. It is an alternative narrative. That concludes my presentation.
Canon Thompson, it's an honour, it's a real honour to hear you and to see that the work that you're doing for us. So I'll open it up. I hope it's going to be quite a number of questions from people. Yes, start with Bishop.
Thank
Harris.
You. Thank you very, very much. Could you say anything about the possible influence what happens in the United Arab Emirates has had on the surrounding Gulf states or other countries in the Middle East, and are you working on that?
United Arab Emirates, I think, is increasingly becoming influential because of the wisdom of the Crown Prince Mohammed. Now, that sounds like a political spiel, but he really is a very wise man, because of all the stress and conflict going on within the country around him, he's managed to walk a path where he's increasingly respected by his fellow Arab leaders. He is increasingly seen as a gateway to Western leaders. He is increasingly seen as someone who is able to walk the middle way in terms of negotiating with the extremist side of Islam, and holding that tension between appeasement and wanting his society to be a model for pluralist living. There are not many Arab leaders who have mastered that, and it is raising attention. In terms of influence of people wanting to imitate him, we are not seeing that yet. If you live in the Middle East for any amount of time, you realise there is a very strong pride in the tribal identity, very strong national pride, and so no one is going to admit to saying, they're doing it right, we want to copy him. But the respect there is for the rulers of the United Arab Emirates is increasing. And the more we talk about that model, the more we hope it will normalise the expectations in other Middle Eastern countries.
Mark Marsford, and then I'll come to John Wilson, Lord Marsford.
It always seems to me that a crucial difference is between a secular state and a theocracy. And a Christian country is not necessarily a theocracy, and an Islamic country need not necessarily be a theocracy. And indeed, President Sisi is attempting to create a secular state in Egypt, as Ataturk did 10 years ago in Turkey. To what extent can one describe the United Arab Emirates as a secular state, and to what extent is it a theocracy?
You cannot describe United Arab Emirates as a secular state. Islamic law is very core to their regulation. There is a civil law, largely informed by Egyptian law, but make no mistake, it is an Islamic nation. They are very proud of their Islamic tradition and their heritage. However, the ruling family are very careful to control the religious leaders, in the sense that in the mosques on Friday, the imams are required to preach a sermon written for them by the Ministry of Religious Affairs, which would be an interesting experiment to try on the Church of England, wouldn't it? There is room for some innovation, but there is a very... there's a wide awareness that they are an Islamic nation and they want to promote an Islam which is moderate, which has a theology of pluralism, but there's no question of the idea of portraying themselves as secular. Secularism is anathema to the Islamic world, because that implies a way of governance without God, and God is in everything, he permeates everything, and that in fact would be seen as blasphemous. So secularism as a political ideology would simply not fly. That's not to say it couldn't be democratic, and there are Islamic models of democracy informed by theology. But that's not the same as secularism.
Okay, Lord Anderson, then I think it was...
You give a remarkable story and certainly a model for other states in the region. What can you say about the profile of the congregations who meet in the different Christian communities? Are they all expatriate, be they Pakistani, be they British, American, or, and what is the position if someone from the local population were to seek to convert?
Thank you. I was afraid somebody was going to ask that question. You're absolutely correct. There is no church for the Emirati people. But in respect to the Emirati people, there is no legislation which has been imposed on anyone who wants to convert. The threat to a Muslim Emirati converting to, say, Christianity does not come from the state, it does not come from the government, but it comes from disrespecting the honour of his family and his tribe. And in a culture which is still very conservative in terms of how the honour of the family name is all-encompassing, this is what you're dealing with. There are, however, Emirati believers who follow Jesus Christ, but culturally and outwardly, they remain Muslim. They tend to gather in small house groups. They are very discreet. They do not want to dishonour the name of their family or their tribe. And quite often, they actually come to the West, where they feel they can worship more openly and freely. And that is indeed a restriction on religious freedom in the United Arab Emirates. But Islamic law says conversion from Islam to any religion is against divine law. You're going against the will of God himself. So it's very difficult, even for a moderate Muslim, to go against God's word himself.
Okay, that was it. Lady Nicholson? Emma? Yes.
Great. Thank you very much. Thank you very much for two fascinating discourses, enthralling and very interesting in terms of knowledge base. I put on the table just for half a minute a very extraordinary and interesting project that the organisation I chair is running in the south of Iraq. It is a religious tolerance programme. And it's unique, it's funded by the European Union, and it is permeating the whole of the south of Iraq. We're just coming up to the end of the first year. It's different entirely to anything I've met anywhere, and I offer it just in case it's of value. It consists of bringing all the religious leaders together, which is not such a difficult trick, and one that's been done many times before everywhere, including also the black religion. You know, in the south of Iraq, there was an influx of people from Sudan about 350 years ago, and they follow their own faith, including the Shabak, who are the non-believers, which I personally think we should include here. 12% of the British population are those who don't believe anything at all, or are atheists or agnostics. And every other faith we have our hands on, including the Mandeans, including the Yazidis, including the Christians, including every branch of Sunniism, and various other bits and pieces. And why it's working and how it's working is that the religious leaders teach their followers, and the followers then were in schools, universities, community centres, churches, mosques — there aren't any synagogues, sadly — temples, which are the Mandean places, and so on. Every single day, every week, these meetings are happening, and the religious representations of the religions talk one by one about what their faith is. Then they discuss what the overlap is. Then they discuss where there might be disagreement. And then they all pledge publicly at all levels not to disagree. And then the audience joins in, whatever it is. I went to several of these meetings recently in different parts of the South, and the police were there, the community leaders were there, all the faith people were there, and the general public. This was a community run. There was one in Mandean Temple, one in the Christian church, one in the Sunni mosque, and so on and so forth. And it was tremendous fun, very lively, very bubbly. It had the tribal leaders, though, who clearly didn't believe a word that anybody was saying, and probably rightly. And perhaps the funniest bit in one meeting was when the largest gentleman there, the Sunni leader, he came last, and he said, "No, no, we never disagree with anybody, and certainly not violently," at which suddenly the whole room started to laugh, and eventually he laughed as well, because clearly it wasn't true. But what is fascinating is in war-torn, violent Iraq, where the heart of this is sectarian violence between Sunni and Shia, that this steady project, all the way down, permeating the whole levels of society, is having an amazing impact. How do we know? Because every single member of the audience is given a piece of paper with a number of questions of it, and they decide at the end as to exactly what it has achieved. I give it to you because it's a unique programme, I think, and it might be worth us trying to see if we couldn't spread it somewhere else.
We can talk after the meeting. Thank you.
Has anyone else got a question for Ken Thompson? Or for Gerard? Yes.
You've talked about the relationship between the Christian community and the government. Do you have a direct relationship with the religious authorities also in UAE?
Yes, I do. What is astonishing is how insular the Christian communities in the United Arab Emirates are, mainly because we are an expatriate church and many of the expatriates come only for a short period of time and then they move on. So you get lots of cultural bubbles of Christianity in the UAE and very little engagement with the Emirati. So this is one thing we decided as a church council we would challenge and change, and that was to intentionally and purposefully engage with Emirati society and find creative ways to bridge the gap, not just between the Anglicans and the Emirati, but the whole Christian community. And one of the things I've been challenged by the Emirati religious advisor to Sheikh Khalifa were to write books that would help both Muslims and Christians to find ways of talking to one another. And one of the books that came out, which was released this year, is called Jesus of Arabia. And Jesus of Arabia, the title was actually chosen by Sheikh Nahyan, bin Mubarak al-Nahyan, who is a member of the ruling family. And this was an interesting project for me because I had to move away from theology. A lot of Christian-Muslim dialogue is all about theology. So what we tried to do was to look at the culture of Jesus and try and relate that to the Islamic Arabian culture of the Gulf. And there's a lot of things we see in the Arabian Gulf which just is very biblical, actually, in its meaning, in its heritage, and it's unpacking that. And it's doing really well. Muslims are using this book, as well as Christians, to try and bridge the gap through culture. So it's moving away from theology and looking at that human flourishing of culture which unites the two of us. And this is now available in all the shopping malls, and it's just an amazing profile, raising the government's desire and concern for interfaith dialogue.
And I should say, Andy very kindly lugged a great quantity of his books over from Abu Dhabi, and they're available for free at the back. So at the end of the meeting, people are free to take one.
Thank you.
Alistair, welcome.
Yes, I can just say how sorry I am to have missed the meeting. It's one of the penalties of being a minister in another department, and things overrun. But the reason I wanted to be here was just to say thank you for coming over. And to say that while I was minister for the Middle East and for the UAE, I had the great pleasure of worshipping where you are. And I just think that's very important to say, because when it's so difficult to convey to people that you can worship freely in the UAE, it's very important to be able to say you've been there, you've done that, and how important it is. There's a terrible tendency in this country to treat all the Gulf countries as exactly the same, and they're not. And the fact that you're here to make clear what happens there is very important. I came away from my time in the Middle East believing much more firmly than I had done when I first started the role about how important religious tolerance is. Tolerance in the first place. There's a bit of time in some places before you get to freedom. But actually, if you're religiously intolerant, then your society is doomed, because it is a cancer that will seep into all other parts of society. Because as soon as you're free to declare that somebody else is the other and persecute them, particularly if you're able to say that that your God thinks it's all right, actually the region has much less hope than it ought to have. And being able to be there to wave a flag of tolerance is absolutely crucial. And Gerard's work and what he's been able to say and illustrate through his books and his talks is vital. So although as far as the public is concerned, and to a lot of the politicians, it's although they understand Sunni and Shia to some extent, it's been a bit of a sideshow compared with the larger, more secular political issues, and it isn't, because it's not a secular issue there. It's a matter of life and death. It's a matter of everyday life in a way in which is very difficult sometimes for the secular British to now understand. So I wanted to say thank you very much for being over. And thank you very much for what you'll represent over there. And it was lovely to be in your place of worship.
If I can come back to thinking again on your question, one of the interesting institutions in the Gulf is called a madlis or diwaniya. And this is where the Arab men in particular gather together and have an open house. The religious advisor to the United Arab Emirates has one of these madlises, and it's like the ecumenical madlis for Islam. So you have the happy clappy Sufi Moroccans who break out into song at the slightest provocation. You have the rather stern Shiites, you have the Sunnis, scholars there. And when I go there, he always gives me the microphone and he says something like this. He says, "Tell us what you preached about last week." And I'm in a room with sometimes up to 100 Muslim leaders. And he's invited me to preach a sermon. It's quite extraordinary. And most of these are leaders or the equivalent of muftis in their own sort of denomination. And that's welcomed and that is encouraged as good practice among their own people.
Mark? Okay.
There's a question for Jared. Jared, you referred in your piece about Islam and Christianity coexisting reasonably happily, sort of pre-mid-1800s in the Middle East. What lessons can we learn for today in terms of what were the secrets of that success, sort of theologically, politically, culturally?
Thank you. Well, it's quite complex because I think you had a phase that was pretty good in terms of the relationship. Probably from about sort of 635 to towards the sort of 900-1000 AD. And partly, candidly, because Islam was actually outnumbered by other religions. So it ruled, the ruling class were Muslim, but the actual common people were mostly not. And therefore, to some extent, it just reflects the different demography. But also, I think, a very stable or relatively stable ruling class. I mean, you had the Umayyads give way to the Abbasids, but you didn't have, and you had quite a lot of sort of civil war, but not on the scale that we see today. And what I would also say is that you see a very dramatic change in about sort of 1100 onwards. Partly, it's quite easy to attribute to the Crusades, but I would say, to be honest with you, that the great cataclysm that affected the Middle East was not really the Crusades, but the Mongol invasion, which destroyed great huge swathes of Central Asia and Baghdad, and completely destroyed the old order, if you like. And from then on, you see a very different interaction. And you have much more conservative sheikhs becoming very influential. Ibn Taymiyyah, who's still quoted as a great authority today by the most fundamentalist groups. And if you look back at his work, it's a little bit more nuanced than that, but he certainly was very tough, particularly on those he felt were deviant Muslims who weren't orthodox. So I think what one thing is, quite honestly, that the more instability you have, the more religious intolerance and persecution you tend to see. Because when you have instability, people group by religion because it's the one thing they've got left. When the state doesn't exist, when you don't have anyone else who you can turn to, you're going to turn to your co-religionists. And intrinsically, that begins a cycle in which religion becomes the touchstone of identity, and in which, if you don't share the religion, you are somehow not trustworthy.
So I think that is probably the number one driver. But also, I think the funding and the money that have come in the Middle East from the most conservative elements to fund the most conservative forms of Islam in the last sort of particularly 50 years, I think one of the reasons why the Arab world was so progressive earlier was that the funding tended to come from different sources, and to be candid, I'm not a communist, but the Soviet Union was part of the world. So none of this, I don't sort of seek to sort of side with communism against Islamism, but just to say, I think that the imbalance you have in the Muslim world today is that there really isn't any percentage in adopting anything but the most conservative form of Islam, because that's where you can get funding and support. And as we saw in Afghanistan, when you start off wanting to sort of fund the moderates, as we tried to do, in the early 80s, the West tried to fund the royalists and so forth. It didn't really work. In the end, the groups that end up seizing the initiative and winning the war are the most extreme, the most brutal. Because in a system of warfare, your absolute determination to sort of kill the enemy is what marks you out. So when I look at sort of the warfare in the Middle East today, and in particular, of course, in Syria, it's so hard to see moderation coming out of that cauldron of pain and suffering.
Gentleman at the end there. Sorry, I don't know your name, sir.
Yes, I'm Peter Everington. As the father of one of Andrew Thompson's church wardens, I had the privilege of attending the rededication of the church 3.5 weeks ago, and it was astonishing to see a full-blown Anglican service presided over by the Bishop of Cyprus and the Gulf, an Englishman, and to see this minister from the ruling family there giving a talk and feeling obviously completely at home in his call for the bridge building effort of the country and recognising the church and its chaplain as integral to that. And I wonder, I'm really impressed by the courage of church leaders in addressing, yes, theological differences or differences of belief, as in these books. And I've worked in many Arab and Muslim countries myself, and I think the tendency is we're told we must keep off religious issues, otherwise we'll get into difficulties. I ran a student exchange program, and we had a group from Jordan, and one of the students on the third day, to a minibus full of people, said, we Muslims, believe that Jesus will come again, and that will be the end of the world. What do you Christians believe? And so I sense in the Muslim world an eagerness to discuss these things, which I think exists across the board in many countries, and that we could do more about. And I'd like to ask Andrew Thompson if he has any advice, challenge for Christians in this country, for our state, our government, which has its own religious foundations. Is there something more courageous and imaginative that we could do in our approach to the Muslim world and take it by surprise by our own radicalism of the right kind at best?
And could I add on to the end of that question, my specific question when you mentioned about funding, because the UK government are proposing, the counter-extremism strategy is proposing to fund moderate groups here in order to give them more capacity in this space. Do you have any comments from your, comments, either of you, about that funding and what your perspective would be on it's basically public money that would be given to fund, to try and fund the moderate voices?
Andy's doing his death act, so I'm going to pass this to him. Well, I think it's terrifically important to have funding going to moderate alternatives. I suppose it's all the better if the money is actually from Muslim countries, because then it will carry more credibility. And what you don't want, it's a funny balance, because you do, as I say, money doesn't matter. But at the same time, what you don't want is a sort of group of people who seem to have sold out to Western interests. So you need to find a very careful way through that.
It seems to me that working with like-minded Muslim countries has to be the best way through, because Britain on its own will not really risk being the kiss of death a bit to groups that it sponsors, just because it's so easy then to say that you'll sell out to them. I think if you can find countries, you know, like the UAE, but there will be others, which are ready to come in to a project so that it isn't just a sort of British project, that would be more effective, for all that there would be some sensitivities around British domestic affairs, and so those countries might not be so keen. So I think it needs to be packaged in a way that makes it more global. But I think it is very wise, and I think it's very wise. I think the government does send a moral message by whom it engages with, and that it should candidly be quite careful who its friends are, because, speaking frankly of my own sort of diplomatic experience, and you know, looking back at things that I regret slightly, I think in Afghanistan, going out in 2007, we engaged with, we met a lot of rather unsavoury people, and we felt dialogue is the most important thing, we shouldn't exclude anyone. I regret that because I think our meeting them gave a certain kind of message. I think they actually used it very cleverly to emphasise to everyone else around them that they had the ear of the foreigners and they had the weapons of the foreigners, and you shouldn't mess with me because I've got powerful friends. It's a very different thing domestically, but I just think it is terrifically important to remember that although dialogue is good, there's also a message that is sent and very clearly heard when you meet certain groups, and that therefore we should be quite careful. I think rightly so.
I agree with that. In Arab culture, you are defined by who you hang out with. You are defined by which madrasa you go to. You are discouraged from attending certain madrasas. If you're not the right sort of person, you will be made to feel very unwelcome. Coming back to Peter's question, one of the simplest ways to facilitate friendship, and dialogue, relationship, is over food. When people are asking me for the secret of good interfaith dialogue, food is always central to my answer. Arabs, like anyone else, and incidentally, I think one of the best cuisines in the world is Lebanese food. I just love it. Food is a great way of bringing people together, and to have a meeting without food actually implies no friendship. So if you're looking at local initiatives in the UK, throw a banquet. Give the very best possible food, but following on from what Gerard was saying, is to honour those who are worthy of being honoured in terms of seeking to be sincere and authentic in their Islamic faith, but being open to the other. And then the message is very clear to those who have a very different message, is that their a religion which promotes hatred, intolerance, we don't want you to be our friends. Simple as that.
Come back to...
we have time.
Yes, we'll just take that view as a final question.
A question, I wondered if there could be a comment on the different strand of Islam that is practiced in Oman, and on the way in which it facilitates, indeed encourages and makes possible, the separation of powers that some other aspects of Sharia law make difficult. Somehow in Oman, this seems to be absolutely fine, and of course the faith in Oman began at the very, very beginning of Islam, and in Basra, funny enough, and has flourished ever since in Yemen and in Oman. And on the UK aspect, it would seem to me, coming from only one angle, obviously, as a peer here, that the problem in Britain is ignorance of religion at all. There's almost no teaching on any faith. Poor school teachers don't get properly briefed, don't get properly taught, and it just somehow is skated over. There's certainly a huge ignorance of Islam, even among Muslims, and a massive ignorance of Christianity, of Judaism, and any other faith you care to name. I think it's ignorance more than anything else in the UK, in my opinion, among young people.
Is that a comment?
Could you throw what's the question in that?
The question was how, in your enormous experience, and maybe your colleagues as well, how is it that the separation of powers that the Omani branch of Islam had from the very beginning, how could that be compatible with Sharia law? Because the Omanis certainly practice Islam.
Well, I would have a different reading of Ibadi Islam too. Oman is in fact a very controlled environment. When you work in Oman and live in Oman, Christian, for even our bishop, needs a special preacher's reader to go into Oman. Oman and Ibadi Islam seem to have a very pluralist embracing of the other. But I think it's skin deep, to be honest. It has a great maritime trade and tradition, but that's more driven by trade and economy rather than Islamic theology. So when you go into the interior of Oman, you will encounter attitudes not dissimilar to Wahhabism, which is a much more definitive stand on the other, which is quite negative. So Oman is a country of many parts. The cuddly part, if I may use that phrase, is driven more by economic trade and relationship rather than the theology itself. Having said that, there are some very interesting aspects of Ibadi Islamic law which implies a greater openness to Christianity, but in practice it's a mixed bag. The most tolerant Islamic school, I think, to Christianity is the Shiite religion. The Shiites have a theology of suffering, they have a theology of being a minority, and so they are in a much better place for understanding the Christian people as a persecuted minority, and there's a lot more dialogue take place between the Shiites and the Christians than we realise. The other school of Islam which seemed to embrace a more openness to the other is Maliki school of Islam, which is what we find in the United Arab Emirates, it's what we find in Bahrain. And in fact, recently my bishop was visiting the king of Bahrain, who told him very directly that the reason why Bahrain has religious freedom is because they subscribe to the Maliki school of Islam. I won't go into the details of why Maliki school of Islam is different, say, to the Hanbali, which informed Wahhabism. But there's a very definite theology of openness, which is more so than Ibadi Islam.
Okay. Well, would you like to make a closing comment, Gerard?
No. Well, I came across Andy really in his book, and I read his book about Christianity in the UAE, and I felt in it and in his later book, you know, that he was someone who really knew how to talk about and write about such a sensitive topic, actually, and do it with great sort of sensitivity, and understood how to write a book that was both quite candid about Christianity, but also very acceptable to Muslims. And that was, you know, partly why I was so keen that he should come, and why I'm so grateful to him for coming, because as I think you've heard, he has a terrifically deep understanding, as well as an amazing backstory that he's very shy about, which, you know, you'll have to catch him separately and sort of ask him his experiences in Turkey and in Egypt and so forth. It is a very, you know, it is a very dark story in many ways. The history, you know, the religions of the Middle East, which were so diverse, and so there's such a rich diversity there that Muslims benefited from as well as everybody else. That it's refreshing for me, especially after 4 years of sort of reading about the disappearing religions of the Middle East. You know, it's so refreshing to reflect upon areas of the world where that isn't happening. And so I'm very grateful to Andy, and I'm very grateful to you, Baroness Berridge, for hosting us today.
Thank you, Gerard, and thank you, Callan Thompson. Thank you. It has been a real honour to meet you. I know that as colleagues will know, we chair a number of these meetings, and as I said at the beginning, you came recommended by Alistair, so I thought we might be onto a good thing. But it's incredible to hear you talk about your own faith confidently and securely, but also obviously the engagement, the deep personal engagement and deep respect and love you clearly have for UAE and for its leaders is quite compelling. And just mentioning finally Emma's comment, I'm very keenly aware, even doing the Freedom of Religion or Belief, that you know our knowledge of the religious groups in the UK even is not what I think as a legislator it should be, that we increasingly need to understand much more about religion as legislators. To when we look out there at our society, everyone's saying, obviously, Western Europe's becoming more secular, but we have a diversity which we hope is pluralistic and peaceful in this country. But I think understanding in the way that you understand the theology of the different groups and the politics and the culture is something we as legislators really need to understand Britain today. So thank you so much for coming, and pass on our thanks to the UAE Embassy for bringing you here. It's been very valuable, and I have taken some great notes here, and we do hope that you'll come and visit us again, and I hope that if I'm ever in the UAE that I'll come and worship at St Andrew's. So thank you so much.
Thank you.